welcome to the Wine Access Unfiltered Podcast. It is the fifth most planted grape in the world, the most planted white wine grape in California, and yet it feels like everyone kind of hates Chardonnay. I don't get it. I love Chardonnay. I don't know what the deal is, but I feel like the world is out to get Chardonnay, and we are talking about its reputation in the wine world and why it could really use the help of some PR to spin it around, because I've got some theories on why this is the case, but you should definitely be loving Chardonnay more than you already are. And chances are, those of you who claim to hate Chardonnay actually might secretly love it. More on that in a second. But in the interest of keeping in the theme with making you the savviest wine buyer you can be out there in the wild, we're tackling this very misunderstood grape greatness that is Chardonnay, in the hopes that you can roam the aisles and find exactly what kind of Chardonnay you might like to drink, because there's a lot of different ways to enjoy Chardonnay. There's more than one way to eat a Reese's, as they say. So we're going to navigate that. And with me to help is a, we'll call you a newcomer, but you're not like super, super new, but Koki of Koki's World of Wine. She's a wine blogger, sommelier, a wine student, and she's brought along 300,000 plus of her closest friends for the ride on Instagram as she makes her way toward a dual certification of Master of Wine and Master Sommelier. I'm effing exhausted just watching you. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Yeah, thanks for having me.
How old are you? Can we say your age?
So I'm 23.
She a baby.
Yeah, that's it.
She a baby. I love it. No, it's great. I was definitely not blind tasting when I was 23. I was doing all blind tasting, nothing but blind tasting, because I didn't know ever what was in my glass. So you're way ahead of me on that. And I also love that you're in the wine influencer sphere. How do you feel about the word? Are you pro influencer or like you're not into it?
You know, I do think that the word itself, where you someone who has influence, is accurate, I would say. But when it comes to using it, what the reputation of the word, I'm not a big fan. I think for me, you know, people just have the, I follow this account called Influencers in the Wild, and it's just people doing silly things, you know, like for the camera. And I definitely don't relate to that. So I think it's technically true, but I really don't use that word. I like to clarify and say more like wine education and I don't know. How do you feel about it?
I feel like Chardonnay and influencer are like kind of related in this weird way, right? Like there's so many bad examples of both that it sort of usurped like the, you know, what it actually means. But I was speaking last week in Paso at this wine conference about social media and wine influencers. And one of the points that I made was like, you know, I asked everyone in the audience, raise your hand if you think influencer is a bad word or has a negative connotation. And at first everyone was like kind of shy about raising their hands. And then I was like, it's okay. Like you can tell me. And like the whole room was like anti-influencer. And then I put up a slide of Robert Parker, Becky Wasserman, and Kermit Lynch. And I was like, We have a very long history of wine influencers in our world. And these guys are all wine influencers. They've just influenced in different ways. So I think the word has sort of like taken on this very interesting definition because of some others who have, you know, as you said, influencers in the wild is a great example.
Do it for the gram.
Do it for the gram. But I love what you're doing. I think it's super fun. You have brought along people for the journey, but it like kind of started as just like a way to like help your parents, friends or something. Did I read that?
Yeah, exactly. I just, I was learning all this cool stuff in wine class and I thought I gotta, you know, share this. So yeah, I started in little videos for my parents and their friends and I never imagined it would take off, but yeah.
Here you are.
Here we are.
Here we are. And climbing, which is great. So what's on the agenda? You've been traveling a lot and you're like in between trips right now?
Yeah, in between and sort of starting, I don't have any exams until next year. So developing a study plan to really nail those well is kind of what I'm up to now and try and study.
And what are you at? What are you at now?
So I'm going to the advanced course for the Court of Master Sommeliers for people listening. And that's the, I guess, third level of the four. And so that you have to take the course before you go to the exam, which would be early next year. So that's one part of it. And then the second thing that I'm preparing for is the Master of Wine exam. So hopefully I'll be admitted this summer. And then the first exam will be next spring/summer. So two really big exams that I want to nail. So I've got to start studying now. And a great study plan is the key to doing well, is what I've learned along my way. So I've got to get that in place. So I kind of have a month or so now to really nail it in and make sure that week by week and day by day I have everything lined out.
And are you working as a SOM right now?
No, not on the floor right now.
Are you going to go back to it, you think, or no?
I think I will before the exam, just because it's part of the exam next year. But previously, I was at the Four Seasons, which was pretty cool. I like the high level of service and the, you remember last time that you like ice in your water, but your husband doesn't. So here we go. We have it. Or you don't even say
just
it.
Do
you
it.
Just do it. I love it. I love being that level.
I always loved working at places where you could get to know the guests a little bit and have, you know, different kinds of experiences within the realm of one night. But it's so fun. Have you seen The Bear?
Yeah, I've seen bits of it. I haven't watched the whole thing. What do you think?
I love it. But there's a great episode in there in season two. The cousin goes and works. He stages at what's supposed to be basically a 3 Michelin starred restaurant. I think they filmed it at Ever in Chicago, which is Curtis Duffy's place. And it kind of shows you all of those like back end things of like, you know, researching your guests and like going above and beyond and like remembering little things and those like surprise and delight moments that we all enjoy in the restaurant. But
yeah, totally.
I miss those moments. I don't miss being on the floor for all the other moments, but
chaos. I got so many concussions working at the Four Seasons too, from like running into the bartender around the corner, bonking my head, standing up on the rack.
Is that a reflection of working service or is that just you? Because I feel like
I just like to move fast. Everyone tells me I do everything too quickly, and I think that my time on the floor is no different. Of course, I'm not running across the floor, but behind the scenes, like if you ordered some wine, it'll be there soon.
All right. Well, we've got some Chardonnay to drink. I didn't even ask you. Do you like Chardonnay?
I like everything, to be honest. I am not picky. I just find myself observing all the time.
Okay.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
All right. Well, good. I'm glad, because that would have been a really uncomfortable conversation if...
I mean, that would be uncomfortable for me in my life if I didn't like Chardonnay too.
I mean, there are grapes that I don't necessarily enjoy, but I drink because, you know, you got to do it. But no, I love Chardonnay. When people ask me what my desert island like grape is, it's Chardonnay because... as we're going to discuss, it's made in so many different ways that, like, if you have to pick one, it's pretty good pick. So, all right, we're going to jump into the second. Before we get there, let's talk about what's going on in the wine world. Okay, we have to start with Florida, which I love Florida. I love visiting Florida. Governor DeSantis, politics aside, has done something great for the state of Florida, which I didn't even know was missing from the state of Florida. We have these very weird wine laws all across the country. All the states have different things. I'm sure you're in Canada. I'm sure you've experienced the same thing, right?
We have lots of wild things going on in Ontario.
Yeah. One of these things in the state of Florida was they did not have super large format bottles until a few days ago. So they would go all the way up to about 3 liters. And now Governor DeSantis has just signed in to law that you can have 4.5, 6, 9, 12, and 15 liter glass bottles. So that's exciting. I feel like that's a weird law to have.
Like you couldn't sell them there?
I guess not. No, I guess like the deal. Yeah. I mean, those are also like, as you know, those are not bottles that you often see in stores, but it's
no, and for listeners, they're not really like, we're not talking bulk wine here. We're talking like,
right?
We're talking fine, not fine wine necessarily, but fun party bottles. Like you may go to a huge luxurious party and they might have a 15 liter bottle of champagne and they have a whole device to help pour it on a like crank and everything. It's really cool. So it's a fun celebratory thing.
Yeah, no, excellent point. We love champagne in big bottles. That's like the ideal way to enjoy champagne.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that like this was like of all the things to rectify in the wine world on the law front, like this was the one that they chose, but like I'll take it.
You know, we got to take what we can get.
So Governor DeSantis, I appreciate this one thing that you've done for the wine world.
Thank you.
Okay, next. Very big news coming out of Napa. I know we actually met in person for the very first time in Napa when we had drinks at the Charter Oak.
Good things happen in Napa.
Good things happen in Napa. I lived there for many, many years. One of the things that has just happened, which is very interesting and very big news coming out of there, is Trinchero Family Estates has just partnered with David Abreu. David Abreu is probably the most famous viticulturist in Napa Valley. Like, he is very well known for being the guy who plants and farms vineyards like Spotswood, Harlan, Bryant Family, like all the big 100-point wines that we all know and want to collect and drink. He's the guy that plants them. In fact, we were actually just talking recently, like, if you were to go into Napa Valley and start a winery, like, you would probably hire David Abreu to plant your vineyard, Philippe Alca to make your wine, and Howard Backen to build your winery. Like, those are the three names that kind of go together. Anyway, David Abreu has always been a very famous viticulturist, and he has his own label that this guy Brad Grimes makes, and it's wonderful wine, delicious wine that I'm a huge fan of, single site, single vineyard. But they have famously been, you know, wines that, like, that's all they do. Like, they don't, Brad doesn't consult on any other wines. This is, like, the focus of their, that one project. And this is the very first time that I've ever seen David actually partner with another winery and Brad kind of come along for the ride. So Brad is actually going to be consulting on this project for Trinchero Family Wines, which, and here's sort of the punchline of all of this, Trinchero, you may not know by name, but you definitely know by some of the wines that they make. So they're very famous for some of their brands, including Sutter Home, Nyers Vineyards, Ménage à Trois, which I'm sure many people have seen, Joel Gott Wines. These guys are really kind of making a play to include more higher and more high-end wine in their portfolio, but they've traditionally been on, like, the non-luxury side of things, and now this is their move.
And it's not an April Fool's joke.
It's not an April Fool's joke. Yes. Thank you for asking. Cause when I mentioned this to you earlier, you're like, no, this is April Fool's, because we're filming this on April 1st. Not an April Fool's joke. No, this is real. This is actually happening. And I think it's a little bit of a signal for Napa Valley, right? Like, I think you're gonna start seeing, like, Trinchero is Napa based and they don't have a higher end division. But I will be curious to see, like, if this does anything for the rest of the portfolio, because they really have not had any high-end wines, though I have heard that their tasting experience is quite nice. Have you ever visited that property, that winery?
No, but I have been, someone recommended that I go there because of the experience. So
yeah, interesting. I've heard good things. Where do you like to taste in Napa? You've tasted a few places.
I like a mix of things. I like to go to new places every time I go back, but highlights include Steve Mathiasen, for sure. He's just like the coolest. I like to meet, you know, some like people who are interested in different areas, some big, some small. So he's probably been my favorite, most exciting hangout so far.
I love that. Steve's very cool. Yeah. Steve and Jill are very cool.
Yeah, totally. And their tomatoes. You got to really, like, nail down your visit time for what vegetables and fruits you like, because they grow them all.
Pro tip. Yeah. Pro tip. Yeah, tomato season, summertime.
No, they're so sweet and just so exciting what they're doing. So it's a cool, different perspective on
what's yeah. going on in Napa. Yeah, for those who don't know Mathiasen, Steve Mathiasen got very famous in, at least within the Valley, because he was actually the very first to take a high-end vineyard fully biodynamic. So he took the Isley Vineyard, which was then under the stewardship of the Arajos. He took that biodynamic, and that's been continued by those that own it now. But their personal project is they focus on minimalist winemaking, minimal intervention farming, biodynamic farming, regenerative farming. And then their grape varieties are very interesting. So they use a lot of, like, things that you would not expect in Napa Valley, like Rebbola Jala, and he makes vermouth and very delicious Cabernet, but, like, in, like, a very crunchy sort of old world style. Did you have a favorite wine when you visited?
I really like the vermouth, not technically wine, but that was awesome. I think it's, you feel like you're in Sonoma sometimes when you're hanging out with them. You're like, this is too, like, fun. Not that Napa's not fun, but it's, like, it's too crazy and exciting and I don't know, sort of rogue to feel like it's Napa, but he's pushing everyone to be a little more experimental. So I think that's really cool.
Totally. Yeah. There's not a lot of experimentation happening in Napa Valley, mostly because it's not economical to do so, but we appreciate
Steve Mathiasen.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, we're going to jump into all things Chardonnay in just a second, but this is your gentle but friendly reminder to make sure that you are subscribed to this podcast. Make sure that you, if you're watching this on YouTube, that you like this video. And also, because we're going to be yanking out a wine for you guys to enjoy with us in the next segment, this is your cue to join the Wine Access Unfiltered Wine Club podcast. Wine Club. I always get this wrong. It is the longest name for a wine club in wine club history, but it's 4 bottles every 2 months. I pick them and they're delicious and they go with every single episode. So 1 wine per episode and you get to drink with us today. If you are a member already, we're going to be drinking the Adelsheim, which is a Chardonnay coming from the Chehalem Mountains in the Willamette Valley. And if you're going to be joining us, make sure you put that in either your all-purpose glass or grab a burgundy glass if you've got it. All right, we'll see you guys in just a second. All right, Koki, cheers.
Sante.
Sante. We love this. Should we blind? We're not blind, but should we like officially taste this wine or are you exhausted?
You want to run through the grid?
Let's go through the grid. Before we even talk about this, let's go for the grid.
All right.
Hit it.
Oh, me. Okay.
Yeah. I haven't done this shit in years.
Okay. I'm going with a modified grid, convenient grid.
Okay.
Weekend grid. This wine is clear. It's a white wine. It's kind of like, I would say medium yellow with some golden reflections, if anything, more golden than green.
Mm-hmm.
There's no evidence of gas or sediment. And I'm not really going to get into viscosity today. We can talk about alcohol later. Viscosity is the tears, the amount of tearing.
Yep.
And everybody, viscosity and the legs on your wine do not indicate quality.
Correct.
That's a myth.
It indicates viscosity, which is a measure of either sugar or alcohol. These are like moderate tears. They're just moderate. They're like falling relatively slowly. This is a 12.5% alcohol wine. There is no residual sugar in this. Like we said, this is falling right in that moderate category.
Yeah.
Nose?
On the nose, the wine is clean, meaning no fault that we're getting, at least for me.
Nope.
There's a good amount of intensity, kind of like medium plus to pronounced intensity, and it's this beautiful yellow fruits, kind of like lemons, and
you get like golden apples in there.
Yeah, golden. It's very yellow and golden, and I really like to use colors.
Same.
Kind of like pie crust, like some pastries.
Mm-hmm.
Really beautiful. There's a creamy element, almost like lemon icing.
Yeah.
On a cupcake.
What's that? There's like a lemon, like a frosted lemon dessert that I'm thinking of that it kind of reminds me of. I don't know what it's called, but like you kind of see it in like a, you can get it at like gas stations sometimes. I'm sure somebody listening out there will be like raising their hand, but.
Interesting.
Almost like a lemon loaf, right? Like maybe they get it at like Starbucks.
It's very yellow. Like you wouldn't use, I wouldn't be using red or green to describe this wine at all. It's yellow and golden to me.
Yeah, agreed.
And is there evidence of oak? You know, there's definitely something that's like warm and creamy going on.
Well, you mentioned pie crust.
Yeah, I think there definitely is some oak, but it's not like an oaky Chardonnay, I would say. Correct. It's very well integrated and complex. So complexity is indication of quality. We're impressed on the nose.
We like the nose.
Move on to the palate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really like when wines are kind of just like all in one and you don't feel the different elements sticking out. It's really balanced. So this wine is super balanced. I appreciate the alcohol not being super high, which we see often these days. So 12.5 is a nice area to be in.
Mm-hmm.
The acidity is kind of like moderate plus, and it's got some beautiful length. So I didn't really touch on everything there, but
that was great. And I think all the things that you mentioned on the nose are continuing onto the palate. Sometimes you have like completely different things that happen. But again, like continuing with that, all those golden sort of yellow things going on. And we're going to talk about why this is important. No one at home needs to do what we just did, but this is how we assess wines. And I think it's important because Chardonnay is one of those wines that can go in a lot of different directions. We actually did an entire episode on Chardonnay with Dan Petrosky last season. I highly recommend going back and listening to, because there's a lot of really great points that he makes coming from the winemaker's perspective about the grape and why it behaves the way that it does. One of the things that he had mentioned is that, number one, the parent of Chardonnay wasn't very noble. It was just sort of like this yellow water. So it didn't really come from noble beginnings. But The other thing that he mentioned is that when you're dealing with white wines, you are not dealing with the skins. The winemaker is just pressing the grape and they're extracting the juice. And so there's really no contact. And why that's important is the skins are really what's taking, the skins are taking on all of the climactic elements. So they're taking on the wind, they're taking on the sun, they're taking on everything that they would experience in terms of weather pattern. But what it is picking up is all of the terroir from the soil. So what you're tasting in the wine is 50% of the DNA. So what the grape would normally do as the Chardonnay grape does, and we'll talk about what those things are in a second, but 50% soil terroir. So it's really picking up what is in the soil. And then of course you have all of the other things that go into it on the winemaking side. And Chardonnay really is called the winemaker's grape. Now, the soil on this particular wine, this is important. And the fact that this is coming from the Chehalem Mountains, this is the Adelsheim staking claim Chardonnay. It's a 2019 vintage, so it's still fairly young, but it's...
As the wine develops on my palate, we're noticing that age on the wine. So this wine's about 4.5 years old. And normally, well, some wines will show that right away on the nose, but this one seemed pretty fresh and youthful. But on the palate, it's turning to sort of like white mushroom and a little bit moist, a little bit like wet stoniness. And for me, the white mushroom is a characteristic of Chardonnay as it's a little bit older. So I definitely wouldn't be in the super young camp for this. I think 2019 is pretty much what it's tasting like.
Yeah, excellent point.
But it's developed into that aged aroma, which is an indication that it can continue to age for longer too.
Totally. Yeah, when we're thinking about the ageability of wines, it's always really difficult to extrapolate out and figure out exactly how long a wine can age. But I would say based on how this is doing now, to your point, like it's developing nicely into things like white mushroom, and it's not getting into these like kind of baked apple, like mushy pie characteristics that can sort of happen with like, especially Chardonnays made in hot climates. I love that it's developing in this way. But, you know, in terms of soil, so this wine has really picked up some of the soil in here. There's a lot of volcanic soil and there's a lot of like marine sediment. So you're getting a ton of salinity and you're getting a ton of that, like, you know, minerality is one of these words that we don't always love to throw around, but you are getting a lot of like minerality on
like wet rocks.
Yeah, like river stones or something like that. Like I'm working on planting all of my like garden stuff right now. I'm like bringing in rocks and things like that. And like that's kind of what this reminds me of is like there's like this like fresh rain quality.
Yes.
That's really delicious.
Especially on the finish, I think.
Totally.
The fruit is still really powerful in the nose, but like the finish is all mineral.
And this is coming from Oregon, which I don't know how much Oregon Chardonnay you've had, but I think I've like waxed poetic about Oregon Chardonnay. Oh, way too many times in this podcast, but I'm obsessed with Oregon Chardonnay. It's the land of Pinot, but I think more recently you're seeing a lot more Chardonnay come out of these parts. And what you're seeing is what I would call somewhere between the old world and the new world. Like you're getting the best of both worlds in this glass. This was aged in, it was fermented and aged in 1/3 new French oak. Again, we're going to get into why all this is important in a second. And then it was put in stainless steel tanks a year later. So kind of going back to all of the things that Koki correctly identified in this glass.
Ooh.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So when we're talking about Chardonnay at its core, I mentioned 50% DNA at its core. There are some markers, and I'm sure Koki knows what they are, as do I. So for me, it's like orchard fruit and citrus fruit are kind of the camps that I live in. Would you add anything else to that?
Yeah, I think that when it ages, it tends to develop, like for me, white mushroomy characteristics. And also Chardonnay is just kind of like what it's not too. It's not other aromas that you would find in other grapes. And so that's kind of a giveaway for Chardonnay for me. And then not many white wines see oak. So when you get oak in a white wine, Chardonnay must be in the forefront or, you know, up there in your possibilities.
True. Yeah. And that is the thing that has sort of separated Chardonnay from all the other categories and has sort of given it the reputation that it has. Things that would indicate to you that maybe this wine has seen oak are all of your baking spices. You mentioned pie crust, vanilla, cardamom, cloves, cinnamon. Those are all things that would indicate new French oak. Now, what's important here, and I think the text sheet is actually really helpful in this wine because it gives you just enough information if you know what to look for. When you see that it's only a third new French oak and then finished in stainless, you can pretty much guarantee that you're not going to get any of those flavors. So the fact that you are getting just a little bit of a whisper on here is totally normal. When you see that a Chardonnay has been done in 100% new French oak and it's been aged for months and months or even years and years, that's when you can basically determine before you even open the bottle that it's going to taste oaky. So it's going to have all of that vanilla, butterscotch, all of that like intense sort of like croissant-y feel to it. That's when you can assume that that's what's going to be inside the bottle. And that's, you know, to me, when you're looking at the descriptors for wines, Chardonnay is really, really helpful. I know you mentioned you like Chardonnay. Do you, you're 23, your cohort, do they drink Chardonnay? What is the feeling around Chardonnay?
I get asked this all the time about my cohort.
What are the young kids drinking?
You know, I think that it really depends. I don't know. I don't think I've really heard that someone my age say to me that I really love Chardonnay specifically. I think they're trying to, they're still figuring it out. If you look at people in the wine scene, obviously they are, but for most people, they're just so a huge generalization, but a lot of my friends would be just starting to think about wine in general and still maybe even in that some of my friends are still in the sweet wine era. I don't know. I think Chardonnay is something that I'll be introducing to my friends in the next 2 to 5 years.
Okay. And what will you be introducing first? Like a region or style?
It really depends where they're coming from. So how experimental. You don't want to scare people away with the big oaky Chardonnays if that's not what they're into, because it can be jarring. And that's why you hear people say, I don't like Chardonnay.
Yes.
You can't not like Chardonnay, I think. I think that I have heard people say that there's some lees characteristic they don't like, but, and I totally believe people know what they like and everything, but I think there's so much misconception about what Chardonnay tastes like. So there, you have like, I don't think there's another grape that can be so polarizing. You have Chablis style, unoaked, crisp, like could be mistaken for Riesling or any crisp white wine, Pinot Grigio style. And then you have this like huge, rich, like golden, you know, baking spice bomb. And that's like doing the splits. I don't know if there's another grape. So to say Chardonnay as one thing, it's just, it's so difficult because it's so versatile.
I agree. Okay, so here's the deal with Chardonnay, right? So this, the rise of Chardonnay's popularity happened long before I entered the wine equation. So in the 70s and 80s, Chardonnay got incredibly popular in the U.S. as the U.S. wine regions were trying to emulate what was being done in France. And, you know, France was the benchmark. You see that all across history when it comes to wine, that winemakers were not only trying to make those same grapes, they were trying to make them in those same styles. But obviously being in California, that was a little bit difficult to make a Burgundian Chardonnay. And so what happened was you saw big producers start to make very rich, full-bodied, oaky Chardonnays. And people loved them. They got very, very popular in Chardonnay. Up until the mid-90s was actually the most planted grape in Napa Valley before it was superseded by Cabernet Sauvignon. Today, America's number one selling Chardonnay in the U.S. is Kendall Jackson Vintner's Reserve. For 30 years, that has been the most popular brand of Chardonnay, which is a very rich, very oaky Chardonnay. And one thing that I will say about Kendall Jackson, because we have to talk a little bit about the styles and how these wines are made, as we talk about Chardonnay in this style, one thing that you definitely don't want to do, and this kind of like plays into this, like how to be a savvy wine buyer, the one thing that you don't want to do is if you go into a wine shop and you want a rich, oaky, buttery Chardonnay, you should be spending about $20 plus. Because if you're not, there's a high likelihood that there is synthetic flavoring in those wines in that sub $20 category. They probably use oak chips or liquid oak or something like that. And for some people, that's not always a pleasant reaction. The exception to that rule is Kendall Jackson Vintner's Reserve. And I don't know if you know this, but they actually physically barrel ferment all of their Chardonnay in actual new French oak barrels. They do lees stirring, they do batonnage, and they age it in real French oak barrels. And it's like a $15 wine, which is crazy. So there is an exception to that rule. Yeah, I went there. I saw it. It's real.
Yeah. Wow.
I was blown away.
How many barrels do they have in there?
Thousands. It's a popular Chardonnay, so they make quite a bit of it. But and this is kind of, you know, when people talk about big corporations making wines, these are the kinds of things that we always fail to mention because scale and vertical integration can really lend itself to having better quality across you know, somebody, if somebody were just to try to make an oaky buttery Chardonnay today, they wouldn't be able to do so with all the correct equipment and do it for less than about $30. It's just too expensive.
Because the oak barrels cost between $1,500 and $33,000 US. So
exactly.
That is expensive.
And there's man labor that goes into it. They can't just put it into a tank and add, you know, oak chips. That's not, I mean.
And that's like a whole cost that just so that you are using real oak barrels as opposed to oak chips or something.
Exactly.
That you add on. And so you think about it eating away at the profits.
So, you know, interestingly, the reputation of Chardonnay has sort of taken a beating over the past 20 years as people have sort of shied away from this style of Chardonnay that has become so popular via brands like, you know, Beringer, Kendall Jackson, these really popular American brands. But as we have sort of teased about leading up to this, this is not the only style of Chardonnay that's out there. And the one that's in your glass, if you're drinking with us, is representative of how versatile Chardonnay can be. It is produced all across the globe in many different regions.
Pretty much every region.
Pretty much every region makes Chardonnay because you can do it like pretty well. Like, you know, depending on where you are there, it's not that difficult to do. You probably have had Chardonnay and probably have liked Chardonnay and just didn't know it. So if you've ever had a glass of champagne and loved it, there's a high probability that you have had Chardonnay. If you've ever had a glass of Chablis and loved it, you had Chardonnay. If you've ever had any white Burgundy for that matter and loved it, you have had Chardonnay. It is produced all across the globe in many different ways, and it's pretty likely that you've had it and liked it. So we can't be writing off grapes like this. We have to take into consideration where they're from, who made them, and of course, the age of the wine. If you walk into a store and go to the French section and you go looking for a white wine, there's a high probability that it will be Chardonnay that you are going to be drinking. Two of the most popular regions in France are Champagne and Burgundy, and that is their flagship grape for both. There are other places that also make Chardonnay outside of those places. Koki, what are some of your favorite regions?
I think that the Willamette Valley is really exciting. We have a distinct style coming from Napa Valley that's kind of a high quality, oakier, richer style, benchmark style for sure. The cooler coast, so like Santa Barbara area, very much in this sort of style that we have here, where it's kind of like a medium, lightly oaked, but it really depends on who's making it. Australia, some cool stuff.
Yes.
New Zealand always has cool stuff. Yeah, I think pretty much everywhere. You just need someone cool doing things, you know, with love and care, and you can have some great Chardonnay.
I agree. I think all of those regions are definitely regions to look for in terms of style because, you know, obviously – you don't know until you get into the bottle what a wine is going to taste like for real. But there's a few things that you can look for to sort of indicate that. Mm-hmm. One of those things is going to be climate. So if you see a Chardonnay coming from Napa Valley, there's a pretty good chance that that wine is going to be on the richer side. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be oaky, but a lot of times those producers go for that because those wines are bigger by themselves and they often need a little bit of oak to kind of soften them up to bring out some of those flavor characteristics. So if you see a wine that's coming from a warmer climate, there's a pretty good indication that it's going to have those right flavors and it's going to have oak on it. But you can always look in the back a lot of the labels or check out the winery website to see, like, was it barrel fermented? Was it done in stainless steel? Was it done in concrete? You can look all of those things up to sort of discern whether or not that's going to be the case. Mm-hmm. You can also take a peek at alcohol. It's not always going to be the easiest thing to tell, but 12.5% alcohol is generally key that this is a cooler-ish climate wine and that the alcohol is going to be lower and that richer style is not going to be present. Other places that I would be looking, you know, you mentioned Australia. Tasmania and Margaret River in Australia are two of the most incredible places, and they make styles that I would say are more, you know, in this like sort of Oregon style, like it's ripe, but not super ripe. Like it's somewhere between Oregon and California, depending on the producer. The other thing that we have to talk about is the fact that it's not always going to say Chardonnay on the label. At what point in your career did you realize that Chablis was not a grape and that it was a region?
Pretty early on, because it's really common in my house.
Oh.
Yeah.
Lucky you.
Well, not me. My mom. She's a really big Chablis lover. So it's tough. How would you know, right? How would you know? And you have all these French words on bottles. I think we could also potentially talk about bottle shape.
Yeah.
You often will find Chardonnay in a bottle that's
Burgundy bottle.
Sort of gradually getting larger in size as you move to the bottom, whereas some other French white wines that don't have Chardonnay will have sort of like square top shoulders,
mm-hmm.
rectangular ones from like Bordeaux kind of style. So that's also a helpful indication if it's not saying what the grape is.
Good call.
I think that in France, I don't even know that it is about, it's not really about the grape. It's about the land and it's about their yes. style and the history there. So I think they understand that Chardonnay is so, it's like a blank canvas and it depends on the history and the traditions there and the climate. And that's what you're seeing as opposed to the grape. Chardonnay doesn't really have that much of its own flavor. And so that richer style is pretty much due to oak.
Yeah.
So if you don't like Chardonnay, you probably just don't like oak.
Yeah, but you might like Chablis.
Chablis is kind of unhateable.
It is unhateable. The only thing you have to be careful with Chablis is that, like, you know, on the Petite Chablis side, basically up to like Premier Cru, they're mostly un-oaked. But when you get to Grand Cru yeah. level, that is when. That is when you yeah. can see some, like, you know, richer styles of Chablis. They're still lean and racy, but they have a bigger mouthfeel. So I always just like to caveat that because if you're spending yes. more than like $100 in a bottle of Chablis, there's a pretty good chance that it's going to be rich. Also, we have to talk about malolactic fermentation very quickly, which is this conversion of lactic acid to malic acid. So lactic acid is, you know, this green apple. It's what makes you feel like very zigzaggy. If you ever had like a glass of Sauvignon Blanc or Pinot Grigio, those all have a ton of malic acid. It has that very zigzaggy feel to it. There's this natural conversion or fermentation, secondary fermentation that happens that converts that malic acid to lactic acid, which is a creamier, it's lactic acid, think like milk, creamier, softer feel. And this is where you're getting those buttery compounds. So there is this compound that comes out of that process called diacetyl, and that's where you're getting that sort of buttered popcorn feel. Interestingly, in Chablis, more and more Chablis goes through malolactic fermentation than we realize. So it has this, like, even though it's lean and racy, it does have a creamier mouthfeel. And that's sort of a misconception that I think people...
Totally, like pretty much all of them do go through malo.
Yeah, they go through malo because the acids are so high. So, you know, this is one of those things that you can always ask, like, did this go through malo? Sometimes it'll be full malo. Sometimes it'll be partial malo. Depending on that response, it could indicate that, yeah, there's going to be some of those like buttery flavors. But in Chablis, a lot of them go through it and they don't necessarily have it on there. So it's not universal in that way. But I think it's an important distinction that if you see it on the tech sheet, like full mallow, warm climate, probably going to have that, like, you know, a little bit of that like popcorny, that like kind of buttery feel.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't say whether this went through.
It kind of tastes like mallow.
Mallow.
Mallowy to me.
I think it went through at least partial mallow in here.
It's quite creamy.
It is creamy.
And that golden character too.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, you can get that butteriness, but to me it's more about that texture, right? That like, mm-hmm. that creaminess, that roundness. And that's where, like, you know, Chardonnay for me is like, is so superior because you can have all of these flavors, but then texturally it's so interesting and it's so layered. And then you bring champagne into the equation, which is, you know, a lot of Chardonnay is used to make champagne, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Mune as well. But that's where, like, texture, I think Chardonnay is such an interesting grape. I don't know about you, but like Chardonnay is my like go-to cheese wine. Whenever I've got like cheese
oh, yeah.
on the table, it's Chardonnay for me, unless it's goat cheese, in which it's Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah, I think Chardonnay just doesn't have many clashing flavors, and that's why it's so versatile in the winery. Like other grapes just have aromas that would clash with the oak, where Chardonnay is just like, bring it on,
let's do it. Yeah.
Chardonnay's like the best party guest, just so friendly, versatile, we'll get along with everyone.
I mean, depending on how to say it, but like Chardonnay really gets a bad rap. Like, you know, you hear a lot of people hate him. Like, I hate Chardonnay. It's like
anything but Chardonnay.
Like,
oh man.
You hear it all the time. I'm sure you get to people tell you in the DMs, like, I don't like Chardonnay. Like, you know, what else should I try?
Yeah, sometimes they do. And I think it's too bad. In the wine world, there's just so many scary things and you get scared easily and people are sharing all these misconceptions. And of course you would think you don't like Chardonnay because you just had a Chardonnay yesterday and you didn't like it. So why wouldn't you say you don't like Chardonnay? Yeah. But when you actually break it down and learn about it, there's Chardonnay so lovable. And the best we can do is tell people and educate.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Chardonnay is one of those grapes that you should spend a little bit of money on. You know, it's not like Sauvignon Blanc or Pinot Grigio where you can be in that sub $20 category and have a great day. There are exceptions. There are some very good Chardonnays, especially in the lean style that we're talking about in that sub 20. But mostly if you want that richer style, you should be spending a little bit more. It's a terrible wedding wine if you don't have the budget for it. If you've got the budget for like really good Chardonnay, absolutely do it. But as a party wine in that sub $20 category, don't do it. Same goes for like ordering on planes and economy. If it's a Chardonnay option, don't do it. If it came from a jug, there's a high probability that like oak chips or like liquid oak were used to make that. And it's just not good for anybody. We don't like it. Mm-mm. But if you do want to splurge on Chardonnay, which I highly, you know, we always talk about the cheap Chardonnay, but there's some really good expensive Chardonnay out there.
I think some of the best white wines in the world are Chardonnay.
Yeah, that's true.
Probably the most expensive ones in the world are Chardonnay. Burgundy must be...
Aside from like the white Opryons, right, which are Sauvignon Semillon, yeah, for the most part, they're all Chardonnays coming from
Burgundy.
There's also like a little, there's Chardonnay produced in Northern Italy as well. Like the Gaias make a little Chardonnay. There's some very expensive Chardonnay coming out of more and more Oregon Chardonnay is getting expensive. So this is like one of those places that like while you still can get it for like $40, do it.
And you can age it. Usually, if you're spending, I would say over $30 to $35 on a Chardonnay, it's a really big generalization, but you can definitely forget about it for 3 to 5 years for sure.
Yeah, I agree.
And sometimes in 20 years, they're still really, really interesting. So
yeah.
Exciting.
And in Napa, you know, you've got some really beautiful examples of expensive Chardonnay there. Kongsgaard is one of the most famous examples of that. The Judge is now like, that's like a single little like Ludi plot of Chardonnay. It's very good wine, but Jesus Christ, it's gotten expensive.
What's it at?
The last I looked on secondary market, it was like between $800 and $1,200 a bottle.
Ooh.
And that's like, if you want to taste like the benchmark, to me, like one of the benchmark Napa Valley, no, the benchmark Napa Valley high-end Chardonnay, Kongsgaard. Like they're the ones. But if you want to expand that into Sonoma, you can bring Marcusson into the equation. Like those are two. Marcusson is probably the most well-known Sonoma, you know, very rich. That's Helen Turley's brand. Like she kind of like put this style on the map. And those wines will go from anywhere from like $300 to $1,000 a bottle. And they come from a few different vineyard sites across the board. And then you have that like sort of, you know, if we're going to call it mid-tier, but like expensive still, like Kistler, Aubert, those are all, you know, great examples of premium California Chardonnay that are richer, softer, silkier in style. Somehow we've gotten through this podcast and not talked about Rombauer. How do we feel about Rombauer?
I mean, they were just sold to a big corporation recently.
Yep, sold to Gallo.
Dude, how do we feel about that? I don't know. For me, it's kind of, I like when things are owned by smaller entities and people.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Now we can talk about more economies of scale, more equipment, better quality for the price. So kind of give and take. Rombauer is definitely an example of that richer style. I always get canned corn with Rombauer.
Canned corn and the candy corn that you get from on Halloween too.
Corn.
Yeah. But people love it. Cougar, we call it the cougar juice affectionately, of course.
Affectionately.
You know, Rombauer for dessert is like kind of my vibe. If you want something that tastes like a cookie, like a corn cookie.
Without the sugar?
There's probably some sugar in there. You know, most wines are dry, right? Like it's interesting. I was like going through Google to find out like, you know, what do people Google around Chardonnay? And it was like, is Chardonnay dry or sweet? And hopefully if you're listening to this podcast for any length of time, you know that like, that is not relative to varietal. Dry and sweet is a style of how you make a wine. And dry is not sweet. Dry is not sweet. It's the opposite of sweet.
So confusingly. It's just such a silly word.
I agree.
Maybe one day we can change that.
I agree. I'm not a fan of the word dry as the opposite of sweet.
Let's just make everyone feel uncomfortable and like they don't understand what we're talking about.
For sure. That's just the wine world's goal in life. You know, I think Rombauer has some residual sugar. Like, I do think it's a little bit sweet.
But it's not a sweet wine. It's like meant to taste approachable. I think a little bit of sugar makes things more approachable. But in the sense of where you're talking about a cookie, it's not sweet like a cookie.
No.
But it smells like a cookie.
Correct.
And it might have a little bit of approachability sweetness, but it's like it's not a sweet wine. It just blends right in.
And by the way, we add sugar to champagne not to make it sweet, but to enhance the flavor. Sugar is not a sweetening agent. It's a flavor enhancer in the way that salt is. So it actually helps to just bring out the flavor. So I don't know whether there's residual sugar or not in Rombauer, but it appears to me, based on the viscosity of that wine, how the flavors are perceived, that there is a little bit of sweetness, but it is not, as you said, a sweet wine. It just makes it a little bit more enjoyable.
You probably won't notice the sweetness in Rombauer. Like, you won't go, it's sweet. It's just, if you look for it now, you might, if there is any.
Yeah. Just the flavors are more pronounced.
Yeah.
But I will drink it. Like,
it's a style, right?
It's a style. And, you know, oh, so one of the things I wanted to touch on before we leave is, like, there is this sort of weird stigma in the wine world that liking oaky, buttery Chardonnays is, like, kind of uncool. And this is sort of what I meant by, like, you know, Chardonnay needs, like, a PR overhaul. Somehow, like, it got like, wrapped up in this, like, bad association of, like, I don't know. People just thought it was, like, not cool to drink oaky, buttery Chardonnays. I think maybe because there was some, like, bad ones made for a while. But there are some very beautiful examples, all of which we just named. And in fact, I have a friend who's maybe listening to this podcast who always makes fun of me because I love drinking Kistler. I will die on that hill. I love drinking Kistler. I think it's delicious. In the same way that, like, I'm happy to have a glass of Rombauer Chardonnay and a glass of, like, very high acid Riesling. But somewhere in there, and I don't know if you've experienced this, it has become uncool to drink oaky, buttery Chardonnay. Have you noticed this in your, like, wine journeys?
Totally. I've noticed that in the same way where people sort of frown upon, quote, frown upon, but as a wine professional and lover, I don't have anything against sweet wines, especially, like, there's some really high quality sweet wines coming out of Germany that are delicious.
Yeah.
So in the same way that some people unwarrantedly frowned upon sweet wines, I think they frown upon Chardonnay that's oaked, or just oaky wines in general. And I think that's a result of this huge over oaking situation that happened, what, in, like, the between the 80s and the early 2000s. It really took off, and the wines just became, especially Chardonnays from California, so oaky that it was literally like vanilla juice. And so I think people are still recovering. If you just took that out of the history, I don't think we would have such a thing against oak. But at that point, it was not a respectable wine style, potentially. You know, it was just so oaked and flavored. So I think now, as we start to rein it in more and have more fruit characteristics and just use a lighter hand when it comes to oak,
and fine,
oaky wines are super respectable.
Balance.
Yeah, balance. And especially at the high quality level, there are totally wines that are super oaky and delicious. It's a style.
Yeah, it's a style. And, like, when a winemaker can do it well, it is,
no.
There are a few things that are more pleasurable. So
it's so textural too. Chardonnay has the ability to become, like, this beautiful, like, especially from Burgundy, like, it's like silky sheets. Like, when you're just got out of the shower and you're just going into silky sheets and you're like, whoa, this is textural.
Yeah. Sauvignon Blanc never does that.
No.
It's just Chardonnay. Yeah. No, just I Chardonnay. Agree. That's excellent point. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so pleasing on so many levels, and I love drinking it. And as I mentioned, like, when people, like, ask me, like, what's the grape, like, it's Chardonnay. Like, it's just, it's always there for me, and I love it. And I feel like as two wine influencers, we have to help to rehab the image of Chardonnay. So
yeah, it's tough for consumers, right? Like,
yeah,
how do you navigate this confusing world of Chardonnay?
Yeah, well, you can start by looking at the French section and looking for, I love this tip about the bottle shape. That's great.
Google bottle shapes and you can see we're talking about the Bordeaux bottle shape, meaning that pretty much never has Chardonnay in it, Bordeaux bottle shape.
Yeah.
And then if you look at the Burgundy bottle shape, then that's pretty much Chardonnay's bottle shape.
It's a Burgundy shape. The other thing is, like, you know, outside of Chardonnay in France, if it's put in a Burgundy bottle, there's a high likelihood that it is a fuller bodied white wine in general. So, like, other regions that would produce wines like that are coming from, like, the Rhone, from the Languedoc.
Totally.
They do tend, like, stylistically tend to emulate their bottle shape. So, you know, sort of extending beyond just Chardonnay, if you're looking for something that's, like, Chardonnay adjacent, keep looking for those bottle shapes. Like, I think that's great advice right
Even outside of France, like, around the whole world.
Exactly.
Like, new world, meaning outside of Europe, producers will pretty much pick their bottle shape based on the style that they're they're making. So
it's almost like, you know, these bottles are, like, rounder and softer looking, like, aesthetically.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, like, emulates the wine. Whereas, like, the Bordeaux bottle is, like, it's leaner, it's like it's more narrow.
Like a, yep. Like a bullet or something.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So we can start you there. Hopefully this podcast helps you to navigate the wild intricacies of Chardonnay and turn around its reputation. As always, we invite you to tell us what you think of the podcast via, you know, leaving us a little bit of a review. And if you've got some feedback for us, we're always there for you in the DMs on our Instagram at WineAccessUnfiltered. Koki, what a pleasure. Where can the people find you?
Oh, they can find me on Instagram at Koki's World of Wine. And yeah, trying to think in the real world, you know, I'm always
traversing around countries, looking at regions.
Traversing.
One of these days, our journeys will take us to a region together. Fingers crossed it's New Zealand.
Yeah, fingers crossed on that one.
Yeah.
New Zealand wines. Hello.
Well, until then, please continue enjoying all of the Chardonnay. Join us with the wine club if you're not there already. All of the information is below in the description. And cheers until next time. Thanks, Koki.
Cheers.